My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. Let me also say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents, but those of me and my guests, and that's how it is. My next guest is Alice Flaherty. She's a neurologist at Massachusetts General Hospital and instructor at the Harvard Medical School. She's author of The Midnight Disease, The Drive to Write, Writer's Block, and The Creative Brain, published by Mariner Books. She lives with her twin daughters and husband in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Alice.
Hi.
Great to have you on.
It's great to be here.
Your book is so interesting. I remember noticing it the minute it came out, and I saw it on the shelves in the bookstore, and now it's in paperback. I continue to hear, requesting the book, having you on the show, continue to hear about it, and people just fascinated with the idea of, just how the brain works in terms of writers, how some writers get writer's block, other writers can't seem to leave it alone. Will you first talk about how your book came about?
My book, it didn't come about in the traditional scientific way of choosing a topic kind of in an intellectual choice situation. After my residency in neurology, I had a pregnancy which was fairly complicated. It was twins, and they ended up dying in childbirth. And after that, for about 10 days, I had what I guess you would call normal grief. It certainly felt like, I was very sad, and it felt very appropriate. And then on the 10th day, I woke up and everything was different. It was as if the sun and moon had changed position. And although I was still extremely sad, there was something on top of that, which was this extreme excitement and feeling that everything was important and that I had to write it all down. I had to capture all my thoughts, and there were a lot of them. And all I did was write. And so I kind of holed up in my office, and I wrote all the time. And everybody seeing me withdraw said, oh, she's depressed. And I thought, well, I don't think so, because I felt very alive. And at the same time, there was a whole grief process going on, but that really felt like it was probably separate. And that lasted for about 4 months, and I just wrote and wrote, and most of what I wrote was complete garbage, unfortunately. I managed to continue seeing my patients and so forth, but whenever I had spare time, I would, if I was in the bathroom, I'd write on paper towels. I would write on my arm when I was driving. That was not very successful. And it was just all I thought about. And then one day, I woke up again, and all of a sudden, I had no urge to write. I had no ideas. I didn't even really mind. I didn't feel like I had writer's block. I felt like I wasn't a writer anymore. And it really wasn't all that unpleasant, except if I tried to do anything, in which case it felt like I was, at the bottom of the ocean somewhere. And at that point, people said, oh, now we see that you weren't depressed before, because now you're depressed. And I didn't really feel like I even had enough emotions to consider that a useful term. But all while that was going on, there was this little remnant of my scientific self saying, oh, this is so interesting. What's happening in your brain?
Mm-hmm.
And having, you know, studied it in medical school, I knew that there was this phenomenon called hypergraphia that was clearly going on in the first 4 months where, I mean, hypergraphia is just this medical jargon for what is basically an overwhelming desire to write, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a disease or anything. It's just a very powerful drive. But it's seen in some neurological conditions, and we know kind of in the brain where it's coming from, and that's what got me interested in trying to find out more about what in my brain was on the fritz and whether it said anything about what's going on in real writers' brains. You know, were their brains overactive in the same way, or was it different? So that's kind of the long answer to your question.
It's so interesting, you know, because I think some writers would love a touch of hypergraphia, you know, I mean, just to when you clearly identify yourself as a writer and you've written and you want to continue writing and then nothing is coming or you're just not enthused, then, you know, and again, it's not exactly block, but it's not, you know, you don't want to paste yourself to the chair.
Yeah.
It's like, then the question is how to get that going. Have you found any ways to get that going?
Luckily, that hasn't been a huge problem for me, but there are definitely tricks that I can use, and I have a feeling that they're very specific to different people. You know, if I knew something that worked for everybody, I would so be out on those, you know, like the Home Shopping Network selling it. However, the more I see people with writer's block that come to my clinic or whatever, the more it seems clear that although there are many different causes of block or decreased creativity, you know, it's always the brain that's doing it, and there are a few systems that are way more important than others, and a lot of times there are extremely straightforward things that you can even figure out for yourself. I mean, it's not like you necessarily need a doctor to tell you. But people who, I think most writers, they may be very observant of themselves, but they're not observant in the sort of bump and grind scientific way, like using the scientific method.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they don't ask themselves, like, what time of day do I write the best? What season of the year do I write the best? Do I, you know, they may think, well, I write better when I have a glass of alcohol, but they don't notice that when they have two glasses, it makes it worse, you know, and that's unfortunately a thing that can really snowball and lead to writers who drink too much and so forth. So one thing that seems to be a common question for a lot of people is, should I write, you know, when I'm inspired to write, or should I just, like, grind it out every day? And a lot, there does seem to be, when I look at people who are really successful, it does seem to be a pretty common theme that you force yourself to write every day. Most of it you're going to be throwing away, and it's those moments that are inspired that are the important thing, but you're never going to get those unless you just have your nose to the grindstone every day.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, there are all sorts of more arcane things, you know, like, do stimulants help? Does coffee help? In what, you know, combination and what ratio of, you know, cups a day and so forth? So it can you can take it to be as biochemical as you want.
And my last guest, Judy Reeves, in her book, A Writer's Book of Days, she has a page on you know, how different writers have gotten the muse to prod them on. And I think she had one of she mentioned Voltaire would write on his naked lover's back. You know, this is how he got himself going. Or Colette picked fleas off her cat before she started. You know, if only we could find the one thing that will do it.
One thing that does seem to be important is that habits are important. Like, it doesn't really matter what habit, you know, Hemingway wrote standing up or whatever, but if it's a habit, then you're going to be, your brain through some kind of blind Pavlovian conditioning is going to start getting on its little creative groove. And may sometimes make that jump into really being in high gear. So if it's picking fleas, you know, that's just as good as the cork-lined room, you know.
Oh, dear. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI. I'm talking with Alice Flaherty, author of The Midnight Disease, The Drive to Write, Writer's Block, and The Creative Brain, published by Mariner's Book. You have said that the drive, that you believe that the drive to create is more important than talent. Can you embellish that?
I think we all can think of somebody in college or high school who was immensely talented and has ended up, you know, doing nothing of that much importance. There have been a lot of scientific studies of that phenomenon, and it turns out that after a certain kind of cutoff of intelligence, it doesn't actually help very much at all to increase your intelligence. For instance, some studies say that over an IQ of 115, increasing it, you're not more likely to be a accomplished creative person, and that the other factors, and chief of which is drive, are way more important. And part of the reason is just a practice effect. If you love your subject, if you work on it all the time, if you can't think of anything else, you're going to get better at it. And we've seen this over and over again in patients who have creative drive induced by some brain change, for example, where like they had no interest in music and all of a sudden they're fascinated by it and they pick it up, you know, even when in their 40s or 50s, when people don't usually have much ability to do that simply because they're practicing. And then the second thing is if you've got a lot of creative drive, you're going to be churning out works all the time, and just by accident, some of them are going to be good. And although that sounds like a joke, even some artists have commented on it. Like Auden said that, the great poets have written many more bad poems than the bad poets, implying, you know, that they've written just so many more poems.
Right.
And there's a guy at Stanford, Dean Simonton, who studied that effect and pointed out that the greatest composers simply wrote just reams more. You know, when you look at Bach or Mozart or Brahms, they wrote much, much more. Now, Brahms was somebody who tended not to publish his bad stuff. In one case, he papered his bedroom, I believe, with one of his bad early attempts at a symphony. But he wrote it all the time. You know, it was there. And that is another reason why drive is probably more important. So that's, I think, tremendously reassuring or not reassuring, depending on what you think of your own IQ. But it seems to be a pretty well-established fact.
Hmm. There, I have a cartoon on my fridge that I must have cut out from the New Yorker some time ago, and it's a image of a girl, teenage girl, college-age girl, writing to her parents, and she's saying, you know, "Dear Mom and Dad, thank you for giving me such a well-adjusted childhood that I have no hopes of ever becoming a writer." Something like that. And you know, I'm curious about that. A lot of the writers I know have had, you know, not necessarily disturbed childhoods, but perhaps rocky ones. And have you found any correlation between sort of difficulty early in life and writing?
Well, it's, I think, completely calm contentment is not a great basis for striving, because striving is just not all that necessary if you're happy. But there are all sorts of ways for being driven besides having had a miserable childhood. And I know I've certainly had conversations with artists who are friends of mine who have been pretty, you know, come from a normal, stable background, and they're sort of worried by the idea that you have to be crazy or, you know, come from torment to create. But there are also, you know, one reason to be driven like that is simply to be born with a chemical imbalance that keeps you driven all the time. As we learn more about drives, for instance, we know that dopamine is probably the most important neurotransmitter in the brain. Some people are born with different dopamine receptors, and they are just from birth more intent on seeking things. There's even something called the novelty gene that's been studied recently. People with it are more interested in new experiences, and that, you know, they don't have to be beaten when they were children for that to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we all see people like that who've just always been either more content or more driven from birth.
Hmm. What about, well, sort of the opposite of that, or maybe not the opposite, a tangent, is certain other writers I know have said that their writing took off when they went on prescription drugs for depression or for whatever chemical imbalance, that they were finally able to get at their writing and continue writing?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And although the answer is very specific to certain individuals, like I've seen drugs that in one person are absolutely wonderful, be terrible for another person, I'm pretty convinced that in most people's cases, at least people with a mood disorder, for example, there's something you can do pharmacologically to help them. Now, that's obviously not the only thing. There's therapy. There's all sorts of other aspects. Lauren Slater in Prozac Diary has a great passage where she describes having how she started on Prozac, and it was immensely helpful for her, but then she lost the urge to write. And she describes herself as being like the Calgon lady, that she's just totally bland and snowy. And the interesting thing about it, though, she may have been a more driven writer before the Prozac, but she sure didn't get anything published until afterwards, as far as I know. And since then, she's been very prolific and writes wonderfully inventive stories. So that's one example, I think, where she certainly had still enough drive to continue to be creative, and maybe even to organize it better once she was less unhappy. The other interesting thing about that phenomenon, though, is that Prozac is in a class of drugs, the SSRIs, which does have a tendency to be mood flattening. And so that means, you know, it's cutting off your highs as well as your lows. And that probably is pretty bad for writers, especially since many writers do have mood swings that could be characterized as at least mildly manic depressive. Mm-hmm. It's actually pretty common. There have been all sorts of studies. In one study, I think up to 40 times more, if you look at poets, they're 40 times more likely to have bipolar disorder than the general population. So it's a huge increase. And that group of people, if you give them Prozac and things like that, they sometimes lose the ups, the stimuli, the excited periods that help drive their writing. But the good news is there are other antidepressants that tend not to do that, and so it's not that they should avoid all drugs. They just have to be selective, or the dose may need to be changed, that sort of thing.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I have a few minutes left with Alice Flaherty, author of The Midnight Disease, The Drive to Write, Writer's Block, and The Creative Brain, published by Mariners. In your book, you talk about writers who have used sensory deprivation to get themselves going creatively. Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, I think writers have used almost anything they could get their hands on throughout history. You know, they'll try alcohol or LSD. Sensory deprivation, I think, has been recently most used by writers with famous writer's block. For instance, Jonathan Franzen, before finishing The Corrections, was trying to write with, did he have duct tape was involved in some way, but he was in a soundproofed room and his eyes were blindfolded. And Mark Saltzman at one point was writing in his car in his garage to avoid the distractions of his house, but then the cat would get into the garage and walk on the roof of the car. And these people were driven. In their case, it wasn't that, I think they weren't, those two cases, they weren't looking for sensory deprivation hallucinations so much as lack of distractions. However, there's also the phenomenon, so many people find it much more helpful to drown out the distractions with white noise, for instance, working in a cafe or like working against resistance in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Because the quieter it gets, the more you notice the scritching of your shirt against your seat and so forth.
Yes.
The idea of using hallucinations, whether from drugs or sensory deprivation, people have definitely tried that a lot, but as it's sometimes noted that it's mostly the writing that comes out of it is mostly interested to other people who are on the same drugs. So it's a rare writer who's able to then tie that to more general experience.
Hmm. That's interesting. Yeah, it is true, though, the thing about cafes. I know, you know, at times I am more able to go and work somewhere where there are people and noise going on that's not my noise,
yeah,
than my quiet house.
Yeah.
I have to get out of there.
I used to work in the emergency room all the time because if I was by myself, I would fall asleep. in the emergency room, it was just, for me, it was a very comforting environment because I'd spent so much time as a resident there, and there would be a drunk screaming in the drunk tank and sirens, and I just, that kept me, you know, kept me awake, and I liked it. And they kicked me out eventually. I was taking up too much room.
But it all points to the idea or the fact that for every writer, there's a different way that works, and there's not one way that works. That, you know, some writers need the room, some writers need the cafe, some writers need the emergency room or the airport or wherever there's action.
Yeah.
And but it's finding what works for you.
And the key is when people, I see so many of my patients who, they do look very intently, but not, they'll do things like, they'll try something for one day, and then they'll feel bad that day, so they'll stop. Or they may say, try a new writing technique, but they've broken up with their girlfriend that month, and so of course they get nothing done, but they haven't really taken that into account, and they blame the new technique or whatever. And you sometimes have to repeat the experiment a couple times before you can eliminate all those variables.
Yes, yes, exactly. What about, well, I'm very curious about writers. It seems that writers, more than other creative types, tend to issue disclaimers an awful lot about themselves and their abilities. My students, so many of my new students will start off by, you know, this stinks, but I'll read it anyway. And I really try to quell that voice because I feel that the longer that goes on, the more you believe it, and if you already believe it, then you have to stop doing it, to stop believing it, to sort of trick yourself into a different habit. Could you talk a bit about that? Well, I guess I'm asking a couple of things. Are writers more self-aware, more self-critical? And well, and should you quiet that voice and do, you know, whatever you can to make yourself feel positive about your abilities and your art form?
Well, I think probably writers are not more self-aware or self-critical. They're just more verbal. So if you have a visual artist, I have friends who cannot speak about their work, would never speak of their feelings about their work because that's just not how they express themselves. You know, their self-hatred may come out in their art, for example.
Sure.
But in fact, there's a book, Art and Fear, which is written by visual artists just about the fear of, you know, doing the work badly and so forth. So I think it's every artist. But whether or not you should quell that inner critical voice gets complicated. There was one writer who I think he said that you can cure any case of writer's block by simply lowering your standards enough. And it's absolutely true. But the problem is most hypergraphic writing, you know, the stuff that comes out if you don't have a lot of an inner critic, it's garbage. You know, what I was writing when I was writing at my fastest, 97% of it was horrible. Now 3% was worth saving, and you know, I published it and have written like 4 books based on it and so forth. But the thing that has worked for me, and I think works for many people, is keeping that inner voice alternating with the exuberant, I don't care if it's bad voice, not having them both be there together, because that's very hard to balance. And so some people will describe that as the editing phase versus the generation, you know, text generation phase, or not editing too soon. But it helps to just have a period where you spew it out, and then later you can feel bad about yourself and look at that stuff and say, oh, this has got to go. But at least you've got something to work with.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have that voice, and for me anyway, and produce at the same time.
Yes. Oh, this half hour has flown by. I wonder if you have any last words for the writers listening, perhaps the writers who are feeling a bit sluggish right now or a bit blocked?
It's going to sound very doctrinaire, but those of you guys who drink coffee every day, like a couple of cups, you're going to do a lot better drinking it every third or fourth day. When you drink coffee, this is the biochemist in me, you get a little bit of a jolt, and then you actually get a rebound where you're more sleepy, and then, of course, you drink more coffee, and that's why it's so addictive. But you very soon end up without getting the jolt. Now, I admit I'm as addicted as anybody else, so this is a little, you know, it's the blind leading the blind. But if you can get to a point where you have it just on days when you know you'll really have a good block of time to write and drink some then, first of all, you won't need as much, and then you'll really be flying and you'll get a lot done.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I don't think anyone has ever advised the writers listening to do that, but I like that. I like that advice. And, God, it's been great talking to you. I know you have another book coming out. You're working on a book about motherhood and writing.
No, It's actually the current title, although my husband says I have to change it because it's too offensive, is Make Your Symptoms Work for You.
Uh-huh.
I'm very interested in how, I mean, illness is such a horrible thing, but how you can wring little bits of good out of it, whether it's creativity or a patient of mine who uses her Parkinson's tremor to bob her float when she's fishing, so it just bobs along without any effort on her part. But I'm also interested in the notion of hysteria and, you know, manipulation of symptoms and things like that.
So. Well, you'll have to come back on. It would be great.
Well, I should say a lot of writers were hysterics. I mean, classic example is Flaubert, so we should revive the notion of the hysterical writer.
That's great. Thank you so much for your work and for your book and for being here.
Oh, well, thank you.
You're welcome. That was Alice Flaherty speaking to us from Massachusetts. And, this is such an interesting book, The Midnight Disease, The Drive to Write, Writer's Block, and The Creative Brain. It's dense, and it's just full of great stuff. And it's in paperback now, so check it out. I'm going to leave you with the notion that you can also go to my website, penonfire.com, and you can check out the schedule for the show. Dennis Palumbo, who wrote Writing from the Inside Out, will be on next week. I think we're having sort of a psych month with writing. Maybe it's for January's coming that we can have the resolution to be more productive or something like that. But you can also get on my email list if you like. You can email me from my website, penonfire.com. I'm also podcasting and putting past shows on podcasts, and they're being archived. And if you click on the radio tower when you hit my homepage, you can go to the podcast link and the archive link and listen to past shows that I know I've said forever that I was going to get on there. And I finally am doing that with the help of Rob Roy and Dave Masso. So thank you, you guys. I'm going to leave you with a quote from The Midnight Disease by Roland Barthes, who said, "A creative writer is one for whom writing is a problem." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.